This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Jane Watkins is a book publicist at Text Publishing. Recently, she led the campaigns for Catherine Collette's The Competition, Gary Dish's The Way It Is Now, Jock Sarong's The Burning Island, and Kate Grenville's best-selling and incredible novel, A Room Made of Leaves.
Jane Watkins, you are a very special breed of unicorn because this is your second time on the First Time podcast.
No, I feel so special, but also what a dangerous precedent you're setting.
Oh, it's just you and Charlotte Wood, I think, at the moment. So
Times have been compared to Charlotte Wood, it's just Jane Charlotte Wood.
Okay, well, in the last episode that we had together, we talked about publicity in the lead up to the Helpline coming out. That was nearly 4 years ago now. We're going to talk about maybe how COVID has changed things or maybe how it hasn't changed anything. But we'll start with second books. From the point of view of publicity, how is it different promoting an author when it's their first book versus when it's their second?
It's different every time for every book that you're, and for every author that you're doing publicity. But I'll speak in pretty general terms. Often when you're publishing, well, pretty much always when you're publishing your debut book, you're an unknown, you know, and people don't, at least they don't know you as an author. They might know you in some other context, but they don't know you as an author. So there's a lot of work to be done to get your name out there and to get your name out there associated with the kind of messaging that will connect with your readers. The second book, people do know who you are. And so that creates opportunities and new opportunities, but also you have to, it's not a blank slate. You have to work with whatever messaging exists in the public sphere about this author. So if an author maybe didn't have a great debut, or if an author has completely swapped genres, or if the author has written something that is like much better than their debut, you've got to deal with the about changing any misconceptions people might have about this second book.
Well, that's interesting. And how, because you must have to be a bit sort of like, if the a person's first book was less good than their second, how much do you want to acknowledge that?
Well, if it's better than the first one, I think definitely want to acknowledge
it. Okay. Yep.
Because I don't necessarily think that's assumed. I think people are often surprised when follow-up is better than the first. And I think that's it's a lovely story, and people are championing authors. Like, people who read books are championing authors, and they want to see them go from success to success, and they want to see them grow and get better. And especially in terms of publicity, where we're always looking to establish a story about the author, that's a lovely story. Be like, they've written a better book. And also, if I've got a positive personal thought about a book, I like to communicate that when I'm pitching, because it's honest, you know, and it's something that you know there's a lot of slick marketing copy being flown around in pitches, and it's nice to have something honest and real.
I remember one thing when the Helpline was coming out that you had said, that breaking out that first time author, it's good to have basically radio silence and then everything all at once, whereas it feels like it's different second time around.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say about that is that there are different, when I said there were different opportunities with the second book, those are opportunities like in book media. So when I'm talking about book media, I'm talking about the broadsheets and their books coverage. I'm talking about radio, the national broadcaster, and their books coverage. And I'm talking about like websites and their book, news websites and their books coverage. Often it's very hard to get into those places with a debut, because they're people who care primarily about writing and books, and they like if I approach them with someone who's written four books, they'll be more interested in that book than they would a debut, because that person is a writer. They're a proven quantity, and there's someone who, this is their career, this is what they do. It's not some like, merchandising of their personal brand, you know. It's not like, I'm a footballer and I've written a book. It's like, I'm a writer and I've written a book. So if you have a debut and you're struggling to get into the book's pages, which can often happen, I won't say book's pages because that's unfairly specific, I'll just say books media. I think you might have even experienced this on the first time. Like, you guys are more open to debuts than many other books podcasts. So if a debut wants to get on a podcast and have an interview, you guys are way more open to hearing about their story than, say, some of the other big books podcasts. But anyway, so if you can't get into the books media space, you want to get into the news media space. So that's like the mainstream. So that's the front of the newspaper rather than the book section of the paper, or that's general TV, or that's general radio. And to get into those news sections, you have to be novel, you've got to be new. And so they're interested in having things that are new. And so that's when it's really important to break out upon publication to get as much attention as you possibly can. But you're not new or novel when you've had your second, you might be novel. Edit that out, please. You might be novel. Like, you're perpetually novel, Catherine. Like, what? But you're not new in this space. So there's no, you're already out there. Like,
well, that's interesting, because I think that sort of stands up to that idea that I think the first time you do feel like your personal story is so much more a part of the story of your book.
Yeah, and that's out of necessity in some sense, because you're trying to get coverage, and that's often what will get the most traction. I think specifically in your case, if you had been a lawyer or worked in advertising, that's not an interesting personal story. Okay, I mean, it might be in some context where you had a particularly compelling personal story, and a personal story that fit in really well with like the tone of your book. And like, I think people who would see that as interesting and funny, like being a sewage engineer, are the kind of people who would like to read the helpline, you know? You know, it's highbrow meets lowbrow, you know, it's sewage, it's engineering, you know what I'm saying? So, which is what I really feel like you do very well. Not saying lowbrow, but like fun.
Thinking about the helpline, as I said, it came out nearly 4 years ago now. We were not in a pandemic then. The world feels very different, kind of making you take on the role of industry insider now. So feel free to pass on any question. But what was it like from the inside of the publishing world when the pandemic hit?
There was a lot of things, in publicity, there were a lot of events had to be changed, cancelled or moved online. There was a lot of fluctuation in publicity in terms of media coverage. The focus was really on covering most urgent public health matters rather than a new book or some kind of thing. Things comparatively trivial. So there's a lot of flux. It's a lot of change. I think you were hearing about people in the industry who were getting COVID and we didn't know what was going to happen. That was really scary, and we were worried about those people. We were worried about our authors. I think I would love to hear the age breakdown of Australia's writing community, but I think it probably skews a bit older, and so we were really worried about our authors. It was, and we didn't know what was going to happen. I think we were worried about supply chains. We were worried about if bookstores were going to stay open. At the time, I'd been working on A Roommate of Leaves, like the start of the campaign for that by Kate Grenville. So that was a really big book for me, and I had been working on a tour for that, and media for that, and that threw that all into question, or that had to be rearranged.
Did that take place online then?
Yeah, is
that
what happened online? And just like organising author photos in a pandemic where people can't be near each other. I think it brought me much closer to my authors and my colleagues because, you know, in a crisis, you really have to depend on each other. I think I was really lucky to be working with Kate on that book at that time. She's really good in a crisis, like very practical and unflappable, like really good under pressure. So that was helpful. Yeah. Well, how did you find it as someone who was podcasting and you were on the media side at that time?
Well, we had just done a whole lot of training and learned how to use a recording studio ourselves. So we had, done a couple of interviews in that. And our big thing, I think, was that we always wanted to meet people in person because it seemed like such an added bonus. But that sort of thing was pretty easy to move online. We certainly get and continue to get a lot of pitches for authors on the show, and that really ramped up. I'm interested to hear what you think. I think of when the helpline was happening, we had just started this podcast. It didn't feel like podcasts occupied the same space, but my sense is that they're like a really key thing now. And I think of that both as someone who interviews authors for a podcast and as an author.
Yeah, they are. They're huge. And your podcast in particular is like one of the biggest ones. And I feel so lucky that I know you. I don't think I get any like favourable treatment. Maybe you feel differently. I think you're pretty fair. But also I know I can trust you with my authors and I feel very comfortable pitching to you. So I feel very lucky to know you. Have gotten in on the ground floor on the first time juggernaut. But it's so important, and it's because it's one of the things that the reasons why I think that publicity is often so much more valuable than marketing, and that's because publicity can last a long time. You know, it's odd if something's printed or posted or published, broadcast. It often exists online for a lot. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but for now we have the internet and it's existing on there. And so that means in 2 years' time, if someone Googles Catherine Collette or Googles Gary Disher, they're going to find that first time interview. So it doesn't exist just at the time of it being arranged and going live. Forever, and that's what podcasts do. And then also podcast audiences, like what do you like? I wonder if you can see why you're so valuable.
Podcast audiences are great. I think about it that in the context of online events. Obviously we're in Melbourne. Online events have absolutely had a big role to play, but I think there's a lot of fatigue around them. I think because people spend a lot of time on Zoom and that sort of stuff, which is where I think podcasts work. Well, the fact that they're not visual and they're not really intended ever to be live, like, you know, as you say, they've got sort of longevity. Now, you used a term when we met up a couple of weeks ago that I wanted to ask about. What is author care?
Great question. Something I ask myself every day. What does this mean? It's a term that's thrown around publishing circles in regards to publicity, mostly. I wonder if I do think other departments talk about author care. I've even heard booksellers talk about author care, but I'm pretty sure it comes out of the publicity department. And that's this idea of, I think it's meant to be the social and emotional support of authors during the publication process. So I think when people say author care, what they imagine is like this gross US bestseller coming to Australia and this poor young underpaid publicist having to like take him out to bars and find him cocaine and like find him like all these kind of awful things, which I think often it is used in those contexts. Making an author feel special. But it's pretty contentious term. Like I recently, I think I sent you this article on Arts Hub that's by, who's the author? What's the journalist's name? It's by Gina Fairley from Arts Hub, and it's about a academic, I'm pretty sure she's from Melbourne, called Claire Pennell. And she's actually doing a ton of research on publicity and specifically author care. So she's researched a bunch of publicists. I wasn't one of them, but I wish, her findings do largely reflect my experience. And that's that author care can often be unpaid, unappreciated, exploited emotional labour from people who are often vulnerable in the workforce. But at the same time, I think often the way I interpret the term author care is just basic duty of care of the people you're working with, like that you know, you want them to be safe and you want them to feel stable and comfortable. I think specifically in publicity, you're asking people in a somewhat professional context, I'm not sure what the right terminology would be, is to expose themselves publicly to scrutiny and to interrogation and judgment. And I think it's really easy to be flippant about some fun elements of publicity, and there are a lot of fun elements of publicity, but there are some times when it's tough. It's really tough. And I consider myself a tough person, and I see authors go through things and I think that's tough. And I do think there's a way to be supportive of people during that time. I'm not a therapist. I can't help with mental health problems, but I do know like the basic Maslow hierarchy of needs that tends to make people feel more stable when they're in unstable circumstances. And that's like, if I'm on tour with someone, making sure they know where they're staying at all times, like what's going to be happening in the future, making sure they have access to food, you know, that they've got some level of independence. Maybe they can get room service, or making sure that they've got, there are opportunities for us to go out for dinner, that they're having social connections with maybe their friends and family or people in the industry who are the fellow authors who can offer support or advice. And just like, you know, one of the rungs on the hierarchy of needs is esteem, you know, just feeling good about themselves. And that's giving them affirmation about the things they're doing well, passing on compliments that maybe people are saying about them but they're not hearing, putting reviews and coverage in context, because often a really tough reviewer will give someone a good review and that author won't know that that's a tough reviewer and they won't know the context of that. So give the context. So those elements of being, of providing care, I think are important. I think they're undervalued. I think they're exploited. I think they're underappreciated, all those things. But I think they are part of doing this job as safely as possible.
That's a very nice answer. And I realise now that I'm hoping so maybe this is the wrong direction on the back of that, but I guess I'm fishing around for gossip. There's a potential for diva behaviour among, I suppose, all of us. I know in a previous episode, Nick Earls talked about an author who wanted his publicist's pillow, like not that they were staying at the same hotel, but actually his pillow from home. Which is quite strange. Any outrageous demands?
None are, I mean, I've heard stories. Like I've heard stories.
Tell us some stories.
Oh, like people asking for cocaine, people asking for like personal items. People asking for time with publicists at strange hours.
Oh my God.
I wish I had a diva author. I can't think of anyone. They're all quite, I mean, some of them, you know, are idiosyncratic,
yep,
but not divas. And I have like the opposite. Like I have stories of like authors being like shockingly lovely. Like I don't know if Emily Spare would be happy with me telling this story, but I remember being in Tassie with her on a book tour, and we'd had an event with Robbie Arnott interviewing Emily, and we were walking home back to the hotel, and there was a homeless woman crying. Emily sat down next to this homeless woman. It might have been like midnight, no one in the street, and just sat and talked with this woman about what's going on and who she's sleeping with, and that the guy she was sleeping with was not being very kind to her. And Emily sat with her for an hour trying to convince this woman to go to her mother's house for the night and go try and stay with her mother because the guy that she was sleeping rough with was not a good guy. And Emily not only gave her money, she gave her personal phone number and said, if you can't get into your mother's place, go to a hostel. She said, I tried to go to homeless hostels and they won't take me seriously. And Emily said, get them to call my number and say, ask for Emily and I'll advocate for you. Like, you just see crazy, people are lovely. Like, Claire Wright's another one who she's always reaching out to people who might be struggling when we're on tour, and just you see another side of someone. And I wish that I could publicize these aspects of people, but you just see really lovely sides.
So what is the nicest thing that an author can do for their publicist?
I think assume that I'm trying my hardest. Assume that I have your best interests at heart. Giving me the benefit of the doubt. And treating the publicity of your book as, I think you use this phrase, it's like a team sport. It's like we're working together. We're collaborating on this and let's work together. We're not on separate teams, we're on the same team. And I often hear other publicists with like chorus stories about authors. And I just think, oh, if you're mean to a publicist, like you've got things upside down. You've got to look at things differently because that's not the person you should be upset at. You know, this is someone who's working really hard for you.
That's good advice. Final question, Jane Watkins, book recommendation. What's something that you've read recently that you've loved?
Well, this is a book that I've worked on and it's a second book as well by a very glamorous Melbourne author called Catherine Collette.
Stop, you did that last time. You can't recommend my book.
It's about the world of competitive public speaking and I think it's even better than her debut at the time. She does one thing.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.